Hello, and thanks for tuning in to In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. As always, I'm your host, Paul Townsend. In today's case, we again see some really fascinating legal issues that arise in the middle of an absolutely absurd circus of facts. We're going to build a little bit on last episode's discussion of retrials after a hung jury, and we're going to talk about how and when a defendant's character and prior bad or illegal acts can be shared with a jury. And we're also going to discuss a topic everybody seems to know just a little bit about, hearsay. This discussion is going to take place within the context of the following story. On February 3rd, 2003, B-list actress Lana Clarkson was found dead by a gunshot wound in the home of one of entertainment's most prolific titans. She'd been working at the House of Blues in West Hollywood and had gone home with a VIP patron for an end-of-the-night drink. This case has it all. Sex, drugs, but most of all, rock and roll. This is the State of California versus Phil Spector. We're going to discuss Phil Spector and Lana Clarkson's backgrounds, and honestly, I could easily fill a half hour just talking about all the things that Phil Spector did over his 81 years on Earth. But I'm going to do my best just to hit the highlights because of time constraints. First, we'll start with Lana Clarkson, though. She was born April 5th, 1962, in Long Beach, California. Her family moved to Northern California, but returned to the Los Angeles area in 1978 when her father passed away. Lana was an attractive woman. She began her career as a model, but wanted to pursue acting. She did achieve a bit of success. She got a minor role in Fast Times at Ridgemont High in 1982, and then a supporting role in the 1983 classic Scarface. She became best known for her roles in cult classic fantasy films in the mid to late 1980s. She appeared in a movie called Deathstalker, and then became the lead in the Barbarian Queen movies, which included a healthy mix of action and female nudity. Because of the nature of her leading roles, Clarkson became a fan favorite at fantasy and sci-fi conventions. Riding that fame, she got guest appearances on several popular television shows like Knight Rider, Wings, Three's Company, and Night Court. But as Clarkson eased into her 30s, her acting career started to fade. Roles came less and less frequently, and she was forced to look into alternative sources of income. By January 2003, she had taken a job guarding the VIP room at the House of Blues in West Hollywood. That's where she met Phil Spector. Harvey Philip Spector was born in the Bronx on December 26, 1939, to Benjamin and Bertha Spector, first-generation Jewish immigrants. When he was 10 years old, his father committed suicide. On his gravestone was inscribed the words, "Ben Spector, father, husband. To know him was to love him." 4 years after the suicide, in 1953, Bertha Spector moved the family to Los Angeles, where she secured a job as a seamstress. In high school, Spector learned how to play guitar and formed a band called the Teddy Bears. They were signed to a limited deal with the Era Records label in 1958 for a few singles they released, but they were promised that if they continued to be successful, that their contract could be extended and amplified. Towards the end of 1958, the Teddy Bears recorded a song that Spector had written called "To Know Him Is to Love Him," inspired by his father's tombstone. The single sold over a million copies between December 1st, 1958 and January 1st, 1959. It hit number one on the Billboard Hot 100 singles chart. The Teddy Bears had a follow-up hit with "Don't You Worry My Little Pet," which also broke the top 100, but the group ended up breaking up in late 1959. Now, it was in 1960 that Spector began working as a record producer, which is the role that would ultimately catapult him to immeasurable fame and success. Spector worked on the original recording of "Twist and Shout," and then co-founded the production company Phil Les with Lester Sill. Phil Les was producing a band called the Ronettes, who were playing a show near San Francisco. While there, Spector heard Bill Medley and Bobby Hatfield perform as the Righteous Brothers. He was so impressed that he hounded their label, Moonglow Records, until they agreed to sell him their contract. The Righteous Brothers then signed with Phil-Less. In the early 1960s, Spector began dating Annette Marar, lead vocalist of Spector's Three, a pop trio that he created. They married in 1963, and he named a record company after her, Annette Records. In 1965, Spector produced the Righteous Brothers' You've Lost That Lovin' Feelin', which was a smash success. That was followed by Just Once in My Life, Unchained Melody, and Ebb Tide, all of which hit the top 10 on the Billboard chart. According to Billboard, You've Lost That Lovin' Feelin' was the most played song of the entire 20th century. So some thanks to Top Gun for that, but mostly Phil Spector. By the time Spector had become an entertainment industry powerhouse, he'd begun an affair with Veronica Bennett, the lead singer of the Ronettes, and they married in 1968 after Spector divorced Annette Marar. The last act that Spector signed to Phil-Less Records was the husband and wife duo Ike and Tina Turner. In the early 1970s, Spector was asked by John Lennon and George Harrison to turn a series of studio recordings into an album. The result was Let It Be, a hugely successful Beatles masterpiece. Again, to save time, I won't go through much more of Spector's hugely influential career, except to say that he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1989, the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 1997, and received the Grammy Trustees Award in 2000. He's ranked number 64 on Rolling Stone's Greatest Artists of All Time, and number 2 on the Washington Times' Greatest Record Producers of All Time, second only to George Martin, who mostly produced the Beatles. Spector produced countless hits for decades for household names in the music industry. If you want to know more, you can look up what's called the Wall of Sound, his music production formula that basically revolutionized the industry, if you're curious to learn more about his career. But Phil Spector had a dark side. For years, he was able to successfully keep it private, hidden, and out of the public view. He had a temper. He was prone to violent mood swings, and he had an affinity for making threats while wielding firearms. In 1990, Ronnie Spector released a memoir called Be My Baby, How I Survived Mascara, Miniskirts, and Madness. In it, she alleged that Spector imprisoned her in his California mansion and subjected her to psychological torture for years. She claimed Spector sabotaged her career, forcing her to become completely reliant on him. She claims she escaped in 1972, running away barefoot in the middle of the night after crashing through a glass door. During their very public 1974 divorce, she forfeited all future records earnings and gave up any rights to custody of their children. She would later claim she did this because he had hired a hitman to kill her, and it was the only way she could save her own life. Now, there have always been stories and rumors about Phil Spector's legendary rage and his affinity for guns. He's alleged to have pulled a gun on John Lennon in 1973, firing a bullet inches from the Beatles' ear. He pulled a gun on Leonard Cohen in a recording studio after a series of disputes on song arrangements. Debbie Harry, the lead singer of Blondie, claims that in the late 70s, she was summoned to Spector's mansion, where he immediately brandished a firearm and stuck it in her boot. I even came across a story where Spector is alleged to have pulled a gun on either Dee Dee or Johnny Ramone when they wanted to leave a recording studio late at night, and Spector didn't think they were finished yet. So with that background in mind, let's turn to what we know happened on the night of February 3rd, 2003. Spector was on a bender. His driver, Adriano D'Souza, was ferrying him from one watering hole to another in the Los Angeles area. By the time he arrived at the House of Blues, Spector was feeling a booze-filled warmth and generosity. He was quite personable and could be very charming when he wasn't in a throwing a fit of violent rage. While at the House of Blues, he left his waitress a $5,000 tip. This picked the attention of Lana Clarkson, who was working at the House of Blues guarding the VIP room from the rabble of the general admission crowd. Clarkson had been down on her luck. Her finances were poor, and she struck up a conversation with this eccentrically dressed person who she did not recognize. Her manager actually filled her in on who it was that she was chatting up and told her to, quote, treat him like gold, end quote. After a while, the club was closing, and Spector felt it was time for his driver to take him home. After a lot of persuading, he convinced Clarkson to come home with him for a drink. D'Souza drove the two back to Spector's mansion and dutifully waited outside in the event that he may be asked to take Clarkson home later. Now, what happens next proves to be critical. About an hour after Spector and Clarkson went into Spector's house, D'Souza sees Spector running out the back of the house with a gun in his hand. He runs to D'Souza and says, I think I've killed somebody. D'Souza calls 911, and on the recording, he relays what Spector said. Law enforcement arrives and finds Clarkson's body slumped in a chair with a gunshot wound to her mouth, and a Colt revolver was sitting right under her leg. Naturally, Spector was arrested, but within 12 hours, he's freed on $1 million bail. Like so many celebrity criminal defendants, Spector was unable to keep himself out of the spotlight. He gave interviews, he spoke to journalists and reporters, he made public statements. While released on bail, he told several interviewers that Clarkson's death was an accidental suicide and that she had just kissed the gun when it went off. Spector publicly maintained that Clarkson was holding the gun when it went off, but that very clearly contradicts his statements at the scene. He told D'Souza that he thought he killed somebody, and he told responding officer Beatrice Rodriguez that he didn't mean to shoot her, that it was just an accident. She noted that statement in her paperwork that night. When he was arrested, Spector hired famous celebrity attorney Robert Shapiro to defend him. Shapiro was part of the O.J. Simpson defense team. In the beginning, there was a bit of hesitation on the part of the district attorney's office with regards to the case. The shooting took place on February 3rd, but Spector wasn't formally charged with murder until November. It's not clear what caused this massive delay, though I've read some speculation that the DA's office was considering Spector's claim that Clarkson had shot herself. Now, that may be the case, and if it is, it's much likely more a factor of who Spector was and getting the benefit of the doubt for being such a public figure rather than an honest approximation of what he was claiming. This is the type of situation that naturally riles up advocates for equal justice, the people who argue that there are, in fact, two justice systems, one for the rich and influential, and one for the rest of us. And when things like this happen, it's kind of hard to argue against that. In the time period after his arrest, Spector added a man named Bruce Cutler to his defense team. Cutler had very recently represented mafia boss John Gotti. Despite the relatively straightforward nature of the case, the trial did not take place until March 19, 2007, more than 4 years after Clarkson's death. Amazingly, in the time period while the case was pending, Spector remarried a woman named Rochelle Short. The nuptials took place on September 1, 2006. At the time, Rochelle Short was 26 years old, and Phil Spector was 67. The prosecutor assigned to the case was a man named Alan Jackson. Jackson was a veteran of the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office and a very well-respected attorney. He is now a private attorney, and he was in the news again fairly recently as he defended Kevin Spacey during the sexual assault allegations he was undergoing. The judge assigned to the case was the Honorable Larry Fidler. Let's take a moment and discuss one of the really important rulings that was made before the trial started. This ruling really guided how the arguments and narratives of this case would go. The most important decision pre-trial revolved around the prosecution's desire to show that Spector had a history of threatening women and waving guns around. Alan Jackson, flanked by Deputy DA Doug Sortino, requested Judge Fidler's permission to introduce 10 separate incidents at the trial. The incidents involved different women who were prepared to testify that Spector had lost his temper and threatened them with a gun, or they involved Spector illegally carrying firearms. One of the fundamental principles of criminal law is that a defendant is not put on trial for the acts which he did prior to the specific thing he is now accused of. A prosecutor is specifically prohibited from arguing that a person has done this 10 times in the past, so the jury should conclude that he simply did it again. A defendant's character is generally off limits unless the defendant himself puts it at issue by making some sort of affirmative statement about it. This is generally referred to as a prohibition against making a propensity argument. The prosecutor cannot argue that a person has a propensity to commit criminal acts. We put people on trial for the specific thing that the state is alleging that they've done, not for being a bad person in general. Bruce Cutler argued that the prosecution team was simply trying to paint Spector as a violent misogynist, attempting to get the jury to convict him because they thought he was mean to women and should be punished for that, rather than because they felt that the prosecution had proven that he murdered Lana Clarkson. It's a good argument. But there are specific exceptions to this idea. When the prosecutor claims that they're not planning to introduce this information to establish propensity, but rather for a legally legitimate purpose. Here, Jackson and Sortino argued that these prior incidents completed a narrative of the state's case against Spector. This is one of the commonly used arguments made by prosecutors to try and get this type of background evidence in. The danger for the defense is that once the evidence is in, nobody can really control how the jury actually uses it during deliberations. The judge will instruct the jury on the permissible ways they are to consider evidence of past bad acts, but there's no referee in the deliberation room to make sure everybody is only considering it for the right reasons. And subconsciously, you cannot unhear that a person has done terrible things, and that may affect you. So anytime a prosecutor is able to get in some of a defendant's checkered history, it's a big win. They won't explicitly argue that a person has a propensity to commit crime, but they don't need to, because the implication is obvious. Of the 10 specific instances of gun violence the prosecutor sought to go into, Judge Fidler decided to allow 4 to come in. I personally disagree with this ruling. And not just because I work as a defense attorney, and this was a difficult ruling for Spector's defense team. The reason that I don't like it is that this incident took place in 2003. The 4 incidents which the prosecutor was allowed to discuss took place between 1988 and 1995. This means that the most recent instance of the prosecutor being able to claim that Spector was waving a gun and threatening someone was about 8 years prior to the incident he was on trial for. Judge Fidler's justification for his ruling was that hearing about these events would somehow assist the prosecution in completing their narrative of what happened in this case. But none of those prior events involved Lana Clarkson. Spector had met her the night she died, and they were so remote in time, it's hard to imagine that they had any bearing on his behavior 8 or so years later. But that was Fidler's ruling, and the prosecutors were able to call 4 witnesses to the stand to claim that Spector had menaced them with guns some point in the past. Alan Jackson's case was relatively simple and relatively straightforward. He claimed that Spector was a rage-filled maniac, that he owned and registered several firearms, so he was clearly familiar with guns and how to use them, and he previously made threats against women using guns after losing his temper. He was the only person with Clarkson when she was shot, and immediately after hearing a gunshot, Adriano D'Souza saw Spector emerge from his house with a gun in clothing which had blood on it and say that Spector thought that he killed somebody. This is a compelling opening statement. Things are not looking good for Spector here. Now, Bruce Cutler had a choice. He could have opted for a mental illness defense or a technical defense. Now, the mental illness defense is more of a mental state defense. It would hinge on an argument that Spector was so out of his mind on alcohol and drugs that night that he had absolutely no idea what he was doing and couldn't have formed the intent to kill that's necessary to convict for murder. There was ample evidence that Spector had ingested quite a bit of alcohol and quite a few pills that evening. The technical defense focused on the investigation, dismantling law enforcement findings, and advancing a narrative that Clarkson had accidentally shot herself rather than that Spector was the person who shot her. But With the inclusion of the four prior gun-waving incidents, the mental state argument became much more untenable because a jury would be unlikely to credit it. Now, this was not a one-time occurrence where Spectre was so out of his mind he had no idea what he was doing. Now it becomes part of a pattern of behavior, which strongly indicates he really did know what he was doing because he does it a lot. The technical defense made more sense, and it had some fine points to it. First, the defense team attacked the forensics. Spectre's clothing had been taken and analyzed. The defense expert had looked at the blood spatter and concluded that the way the blood had hit Spectre's shirt, it indicated that he was standing a pretty significant distance away. The gunshot wound impact showed that the gun had been fired from direct contact with Clarkson's mouth. So Spectre's attorneys used that to argue that Clarkson was drunk and had accidentally shot herself. They also argued that while Spectre was seen running out of the house holding a gun, that was not the gun which actually killed Clarkson. The weapon that actually fired the shot was found directly under her chair. Now, while it is certainly conceivable that Spectre could have shot her, put the gun there, picked up a different gun, and run outside, that would have required a lot of quick thinking for a person in his condition. Also, Spectre had several firearms registered to him in the house, but the gun that was used to kill Clarkson was not one of them. Spectre's team argued that the gun was actually Clarkson's. She brought it, and she was the only one who handled it. There was no forensic evidence that the gun was ever put in Spectre's hand at any time. There was no fingerprints, no DNA. There was nothing that connected Spectre to actually holding the gun. But the ace in the defense team's hand was Punkin Laughlin, or as she was known to her friends, Punkin Pie. Laughlin had been best friends with Clarkson for a decade. She was called by Spectre's defense and testified that Clarkson was at the end of her rope. She was suicidal. In the days immediately prior to her death, she had talked about shooting herself. Laughlin said that Clarkson could get aggressive, but that she was really quite fragile, and that if Spectre had yelled back at her, it would have pushed her over the edge, and she would have harmed herself. In response to Laughlin's testimony, prosecutors introduced evidence that Clarkson had made several shoe purchases in the days leading up to her death, arguing that suicidal people usually don't make these kind of purchases. They also put an expert on to say that people don't make spur-of-the-moment decisions to commit suicide, especially not in a stranger's house. But the idea was there, and it took hold. The great success story of this trial was that Bruce Cutler was able to make this case mostly about the forensics and Clarkson's state of mind. He directed the case that way, and that was his strongest play. Jackson, on the other hand, could not refocus the jury on Spectre, his past, his temper, or his very inculpatory statement. The jury really struggled with two compelling arguments, and ultimately, they could not agree. 10 jurors wanted to convict, but 2 could not get past their doubts. After nearly 2 full weeks of deliberating, Judge Fidler declared a mistrial. After the trial, Laughlin was vilified in the media. Accusations were made that Spectre had given her a suitcase of cash, that she was a Spectre acolyte and completely fabricated her testimony. No inappropriate conduct has ever been proven, but Laughlin became a complete recluse based on the way she was treated. As we've noted previously in the New York versus Chanel Lewis case, when a trial ends with a deadlocked jury, the judge will declare a mistrial, and the prosecution has the option to bring the case again and start from scratch. And that's precisely what Jackson did. Spectre's second trial began October 20th, 2008. Now, this was a significantly different trial. Cutler was gone. Shapiro was gone. The only attorney left representing Spectre was Duron Weinberg. Duron Weinberg was a highly respected lawyer, but he was not as skilled as Cutler. Spectre had another big problem during his second trial. Laughlin could not bring herself to take the stand again. She had been so damaged by how she had been described for the weeks and months in the media that she broke down in Weinberg's office and would not testify again. Jackson also had a new plan for the second trial. He placed significantly more emphasis on the statement Spector made to D'Souza right after running out of his house. "I think I just killed somebody." As some of you listening may already know, that statement is hearsay. And generally speaking, hearsay is inadmissible in court. So why was Jackson allowed to ask D'Souza about that statement during his testimony? Hearsay is a very complicated legal concept, but I'll give you a very brief crash course on the basics. The definition of hearsay is a statement made out of court, introduced in court, which asserts the factual truth of the statement. So for example, a lawyer cannot put Jack on the stand to say that John told him that John went to a bar last Tuesday night if the goal of that witness statement is to prove that John was at a bar last Tuesday. The point of the statement is that it is factually true. Ideally, the lawyer would be able to put John on the stand to say he was at a bar last Tuesday, or put someone on the stand to say that they saw John at the bar last Tuesday, removing the need for anybody to testify about what John said about going to the bar. The problem with hearsay is that it is inherently unreliable. You're asking the listener to credit what a witness is telling them someone else said without any verification that this conversation ever actually took place. There is no opportunity for an opposing lawyer to cross-examine the contents of the statement because the person who made the statement is not the person who's testifying. So, in our previous example of Jack testifying about John, Jack is the one on the stand, and a lawyer doesn't have the opportunity to ask John whether or not he actually said that. There are two ways that out-of-court statements can be admitted into evidence. One is by making the statement not hearsay. That is, by introducing the statement for a purpose other than to assert the factual truth of the statement. For example, if an individual is arguing self-defense, he would be permitted to testify that an attacker said, "I'm going to kill you," in order to justify using force in response. In this scenario, the statement is not being introduced to show that the person was actually planning to kill the witness, but rather to explain the witness's mindset or the motive behind any actions that they took. So the focus is no longer the factual truth of the statement itself. The second way that out-of-court statements come in is if they satisfy a hearsay exception rule. There are a lot of these rules, and the rule about hearsay occupies weeks of a first-year law student's evidence class. So I'm going to be very superficial here, but you'll understand the point. The testimony by Adriano D'Souza about Spector's statement is clearly hearsay. "I think I killed somebody" was introduced for its truth. The implication is that Spector himself was the cause of the death. There is an exception to the rule against hearsay if the statement is made against the speaker's penal interest. Now, what that means is if a person says something which can be interpreted as a confession to a crime or in some way makes them criminally liable for an action, then the rule against hearsay will not apply. That's why confessions are admissible, even though they are also clearly hearsay. If you think about it, it's a police officer regurgitating what a defendant said to them in an interrogation room being offered for the truth of the statement without the ability to cross-examine the person who actually made the statement. But because of the exception for statements which are in some way inculpatory, the statement was permitted to come in. There are also probably other exceptions which would have applied, but for our purposes, this is good enough. Jackson made the statement a decent piece of the first trial, but it was the main event of the second trial. In response, Weinberg took a calculated risk, which ultimately did not pan out. Adriano D'Souza was a Brazilian national. He was a student, and English was clearly not his native language. On direct in both trials, D'Souza showcased some minor difficulties with English, nothing major, but still noticeable. Weinberg went all in on language barrier issues. On cross-examination, he tried to get D'Souza to admit that he was not sure about the exact wording that Spector had used. He brought up the fact that the wording had varied different times in different police reports. But D'Souza was unflappable. He stood his ground and affirmed that he told the police the same thing each time, and if they wrote it differently, he couldn't do anything about that. D'Souza also very clearly relayed the entire events of that night, where he took Spector, how much Spector was drinking, and by the end, D'Souza's English was clearly more than reliable. The trial went on for nearly 5 months, even without Laughlin testifying. At the end, Jackson's summation revolved heavily around Spector's statement, "I think I just killed somebody." He also touched on the fact that Clarkson had no indicators for suicidal ideation. He spent a lot of time talking about Spector's history of gun violence towards women. This was also allowed in the second trial. Weinberg still clung to his argument that the documented variances on D'Souza's account of Spector's statement raised doubts. He said that Clarkson was indeed suicidal and that nothing tied Spector to the gun in any way. The second jury convicted Spector of murder after 18 days of deliberation. He was sentenced to 19 years in prison on May 29, 2009. In 2016, while incarcerated, Spector filed for divorce from his wife, Rochelle, claiming, quote, "she's killing me," end quote. Phil Spector died in prison just recently, on January 16, 2021. He had been transported from his cell to an outside hospital because of complications of COVID-19. He would have been eligible for parole in 2024. In summation, the trial of Phil Spector is another glaring example of how good trial strategy can overcome bad facts. Cutler did have some good issues to work with to sow some doubt, but it was really his ability to dominate the discussion which kept two jurors holding out. It takes real talent to keep a jury's focus pinpointed on the issues you want them and get them to gloss over the issues which you don't want them fixating on. By constantly harping on the forensics and on Laughlin's testimony about Clarkson, Cutler was able to keep attention away from Spector's confession or his history of brandishing guns at his girlfriends. We've seen a couple times now that the shedding of a good attorney can lead to disaster at a trial. Think also of Dr. Kevorkian, who never lost a case while represented by Jeffrey Fieger, but was convicted of murder shortly after firing him. That's not to say that Jerome Weinberg was a bad advocate. He wasn't, by any stretch. But you have to wonder why Spector changed lawyers when Cutler had done such a good job. It wasn't even just lawyers that he changed. His whole persona was different at the second trial. The first trial, he wore outlandish wigs, eccentric suits, he posed for the media, he had an entourage that went with him everywhere he went. It almost appeared that he wasn't even really taking the trial seriously. His second trial, he was far more subdued. He wore conservative suits. He came to court with only his attorney and his wife. He was not flamboyant with the media. He didn't wear any wigs. I haven't found any cause for this, but it does make you wonder if perhaps there may have been something to the mental illness rumors after all. Well, that's the show this time around. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Dan Townsend, who is now my official audio engineer and In Summation's first real employee. Very exciting. And thank you very much to all you listeners. With this episode, we hit a milestone I wasn't sure I would be at after 6 months. So to those of you who have subscribed and follow along every other week, I deeply, deeply appreciate it. For those of you who are new to the program, if you enjoyed the episode on Phil Spector, subscribe and get notified when new episodes are uploaded. You can drop me any feedback at insummationpodcast@gmail.com, or you can actually tweet me now at insummationpod if you like. You can also catch up with me on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. Until next time, thanks for stopping by, and I hope you'll come back for more.